is a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now,
on a Thursday morning, Zanro sitting in the chair with you today till midday, and of course every Thursday, Dr. Carl joins us to talk science for a full hour. Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Zan.
And we have another special guest. We're being spoilt lately.
Yes, the young and incredibly lovely Dr. Brian Dunning. He's not a medical doctor or another sort of doctor. He's Brian Dunning, and he does...
He's a doctor for an hour a week. We're all doctors in here for an hour a week.
By the way, reason for that is because many people feel anxious about asking questions, and they'll say things such as along the lines of, I feel this is a stupid question, sorry. And my attitude is there is no stupid question. So to try and relax people, I call them doctor, but I'm not trying to pretend that they have a PhD, nor am I demeaning that. So in your case, you have a wonderful podcast, which I've been listening to for years, well-researched, entertaining, witty, clever, skeptoid.com, and it always starts off, and he does this magnificent, incredibly cheesy voice, which runs...
You're listening to Skeptoid. I'm Brian Dunning from Skeptoid.com.
Maybe you've heard that voice before in your headphones, and he's here live doing the voice, but also answering your questions. How long have you been running the podcast for, Brian?
Oh, it started in October 2006. Yeah, I had no idea what I was doing, and I think I'm just now starting to get a handle on what kind of a show it is.
So are you the kind of guy that was always questioning anything in the world, always wondering, you know, what the real story was behind, you know, things that a lot of people take for granted?
It's more about that. It's more about making new discoveries and learning the way things really work. It's just a fascinating journey. It's never been about proving things wrong or debunking things. That's a common misconception. For me, it's all about just the wonder and the fun of learning something new.
So do people actually contact you and ask you to find things out for them, or is it just stuff that you're inquisitive about personally?
Oh, all the time. I get 10 emails a day of episode suggestions. I'm never, ever going to catch up with them. It's just a wealth of riches.
Can you think of, just in terms of people wanting to call in today and ask questions, of course, Dr. Carl is with us to answer your general science questions. If you want to give us a buzz right now, there's a number of lines free, 1-300-055-36. But Brian Dunning is also here, and to take advantage of him, what kind of things are you comfortable talking about? What are some of the things, the myths, I guess, you've busted?
Yeah, hundreds. My background is in computer science and writing, and doing the podcast was kind of a convergence of my various interests. So I would consider myself a science journalist now. I get any kind of a question, and it's almost always something that I know very little about, and so I have to do a tremendous amount of research each week, learning about it and writing it up for each week's show. So... Yeah, it's very much a generalist.
And the Minimin lights, he explained that because, you know, the Minimin lights in southern Queensland, southwestern Queensland, strange lights that appear to travel with you around the Bulyeo Winton area. Mm-hmm. And Jack Pettigrew at Queensland had discovered the reason. And then Brian talked about it on the podcast, and blow me down, I quickly plagiarized his work and passed it off, giving him due reference. And it's a fascinating explanation.
Well, you've obviously done a lot of research over the years, and we're going to use that knowledge this morning for the nation. Give us a call, 1-300-055-36. Dr. Carl and Dr. Brian are joining us this morning to talk science. We've got Jason calling in from Stanmore on the line. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how you going, Dr. Zan, Dr. Brian and Dr. Carl?
Oh, he knows how to do it. Yeah. Dr. Jason, what's your question?
My question's it's sort of based on a claim made by Raw Food Diets, which I'm rather sceptical of anyway, and I've heard Brian discuss some of these in his episodes. I'm a big fan. But the question I've got is in regards to the carbohydrate. Is I've heard the claim that when a carbohydrate goes through the cooking process, because water is extracted, that the CH2O combination, the H2O is eliminated, and you end up with the C, which is a carb. But my understanding is it's carbon. And I want some clarification on, is this sort of claim true? Because this was used to promote a raw food diet.
Ooh. Brian, you want
to
start?
Yeah, all sorts of... Anyone who's trying to sell you something is always going to make all sorts of claims. Removing water from a compound that contains carbohydrates does not change the carbohydrates. Basically, what happens, there is some truth to the idea that cooking your food changes it. And it changes it by starting to break down certain chemical bonds exactly the same way as your saliva will do and your digestive process will do when you start to eat that food. So really, the worst that's going to happen, this is a complex issue and there's a million subtleties we could go into, but generally, when you cook food, it's just starting to get digested a tiny little bit. And in no way does this reduce the nutritional content that your body's going to receive from it.
And then following on from that, the foods are basically your fats, your proteins, your carbohydrates. Fats and carbohydrates have CHO, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, in various combinations. And then for a protein, you just chuck in a nitrogen, you add a nitrogen. In many, many cases, you improve the bioavailability of the food by cooking it. You cannot digest a raw potato. You can digest a cooked potato. In some cases, cooking will slightly decrease the nutritional value, and overcooking can reduce it a bit. But you're far better off if you do all the swings and roundabouts with cooking your food. If you can live on raw food, go for it. You'll probably be difficult because you have to juggle all sorts of things to make sure you get your appropriate vitamins, minerals, fats, proteins, carbohydrates, and you can do it. But it's just a lot harder, and you have to spend a lot more time each day doing it. And I don't think there's automatically bad stuff associated with cooking.
Thanks for the call, Jason.
Thank you.
See you later. Josh is calling in from Cranbourne this morning. Hi, Josh.
G'day, doctors.
Hello. What's your question?
Mm-hmm. I've got a question about long-range weather forecasters.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything scientific behind this, or are these people just complete crackpots? You know, because weather forecasters, they struggle to get it right from day to day. You know.
Yeah,
and they're forecasting a year in advance. So.
Come on, they do it pretty well. The Bureau of Meteorology website's one of my favourite websites ever.
Oh, the old BOM, Brian?
Can you actually long-range weather forecast?
Well, I don't think you can do it a year in advance except by analysing general trends and assuming that something similar is probably going to happen. But really, you're just seeing an illustration of how difficult these problems are and how hard it is to forecast weather. The Earth's weather system is an incredibly, incredibly complex system. And by no means do we understand it fully. We understand a lot of the general rules about how it works, and we can estimate general trends over time. But as far as being specific, that's something that you're going to be wrong about almost every time.
About a century ago, people were able to be moderately accurate, with regard to long-range weather forecasts if they picked their time, because we hadn't mucked around with the climate so much. And so if on the 20th of December, in that particular area, we're talking Australia, stinking hot. Well, then you could say if it was stinking hot four times out of the last 4 years, well, this year there's a chance it'll be stinking hot and a clear day. We are changing the weather. If you look at the westerlies that run around each of the poles, running in a westerly direction, they're shifting. So you can think about it, if you look, say, at Australia, you've got the westerlies coming, say, from Perth across to Sydney, Coffs Harbour, and they bring rain with them. They are shifting by about 6 degrees towards the pole. On the other side of the equator, they're shifting by about 4 degrees towards the pole. So if you're trying to go by historical records to make your long-range weather forecast, well, now it's not going to be so accurate because we've changed the weather.
Thanks for the call, Josh.
Thank you.
We've got a science hour, 45 minutes really left to spend with you this morning. A reminder too that this week and next week is the final weeks that you can talk science for 2010 as we're winding up for the year. So give us a buzz, 1-300-055-36. We're talking science on this Thursday morning, 1-300-055-36. Dr. Carl joins us, as does Brian Dunning, who is a professional skeptic. And if you know that name, then you've probably listened to his podcast. Skeptoid.com is the place to download it. If you want a few people texting in and saying, oh, my God, he sounds just like on the podcast, that's because it's the same person and he's got a microphone in front of him.
Imagine that.
So strange. thank you for your text coming through. Make sure you're giving us a call as well if you've got any questions this morning. Jeff in Richmond does. Hi, Jeff.
Hello there.
Hello. What's your question?
When an aeroplane, especially a jet, flies through a cloud, why doesn't the thrust blow the cloud around?
It blows a small part of the cloud around because the jet engine is long and skinny. The thrust coming out the back is long and it does broaden. And if you see a cotton trail or contrail in the sky, you'll see that it will, after the jet has gone, has broadened out to maybe a kilometre wide, but clouds are much bigger than that. So firstly, it does create a disturbance to the cloud, but a relatively small one, which the cloud then self-heals. And secondly, you can see a negative cotton trail every now and then where you can see a hole through the cloud. And I've actually got a photo of this on my smartphone, which I should pass on to our good friend Cam at the ABC, and he can post as an example of an answer to your question.
So it does happen.
Yeah, you got to remember that aerodynamic engineering, one of the goals is to reduce drag, and so you want to create as little disturbance of the air as possible to make the plane efficient. Just like in the way a racing shell in the water makes very little wake compared to some other big boats, an airplane, especially a fast jet airplane, has to be designed in such a way that it's going to slip through the air with making the minimum possible disturbance. And that includes the jet thrust. Anytime you're disturbing the air, you're losing energy, you're costing energy.
Mm.
Okay, thanks for the call, Jeff.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Darren's calling you from Notting Hill this morning. Hi, Darren.
Good morning, doctors.
Good morning. What's your question?
I've suffered from extremely bad hay fever probably the last 7-odd years. I've tried umpteen tablets and all different new novelty products that come on the market. Nothing's ever seemed to work. In the past 3 years, I've been having these desensitization injections where it's a raw form of the actual pollen and so forth that I'm allergic to, and I still suffer from extremely bad hay fever. I was just curious whether it is actually known to work, this desensitization, or whether I'm just wasting my money still on other products.
Firstly, are you doing it with a medical doctor and a hospital and a proper immunologist? Okay.
Yeah.
Second thing, the immune system is incredibly complicated, and so we're still playing around the edges of it. What happens is that your immune system has to be tuned to a certain degree of readiness or reaction. If it is over-tuned, you will fight yourself. And there's a vast array of so-called autoimmune diseases, of which, unfortunately, women seem to be more prone to than men.
Really?
It's unfair. And then, secondly, if it's not reactive enough, then you'll come down with every infection and get more cancers. In your case, your immune system is reacting to something that is not a threat to the various pollens that pop around in the air each springtime, and your body is overreacting. And what we're trying to do via a simple, we tried it before and it worked, so it might work for you, is to give you some sort of minor exposure to these pollens, and your body will say, oh, it's that thing again, and last time I didn't die, so maybe I won't react so much. And so it's variable.
Okay.
But the fact that it's variable is a symptom of how little we know about this incredibly complex thing, the immune system, and we're just trying things that have worked for other people. And it might change, for example, as you get older. Or you could have a sudden major illness and blow me down, suddenly you've lost your allergy.
Mm.
It's that complicated.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Darren.
No problem.
See you later. Julie's calling in from Ingleburn. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Oh, what's your question?
My question's about dinosaurs, and hopefully it can resolve an argument between my husband and I. It's in relation to what's the closest living relative to dinosaurs. I was always under the impression it was birds, but my husband flat refuses to believe this.
Big it up for the women.
Congratulations.
You've won. If you go to the ABC homepage and look up Great Moments in Science, you can find a bunch of stories about that, about the birds and the dinosaurs. How many? Nine stories on this. So the easiest way there is just to go to drkarl.com, drkarl.com, then immediately bounce into the ABC, then Great Moments in Science. And the dinosaurs, okay, 250 million years ago, there was a massive extinction, the Great Permian extinction. 90% of everything died out. Around 220 million years ago, there were three contenders for who's going to be the big dude on the planet. And they were the crocodile-type creatures, which unfortunately had their legs out to the side. And having their legs out to the side means that as they run, they have to twist sideways. And so the contents of the gut act like a piston and squash the lungs. So crocodiles and their relatives can either run or breathe but not do both at the same time. So they weren't going to become the top guy on the planet. Now, the other thing was that 220 million years ago, the oxygen in the atmosphere was not the current 20%. It was only 11%. Birds and dinosaurs have got a much more efficient system of lungs where they do not dilute the incoming air, so they could survive and prosper. We humans, we had legs under our hips like the dinosaurs did, so we could run and breathe at the same time, but we had crappy lungs that dilute the incoming air with the old expired air. So 65 million years ago, the big rock hits. And if you look at all of the diagrams in all of the books, all the dinosaurs died out except for the birds, the avian line. And they continued through today. Birds are dinosaurs. They never died out. They're the only line of dinosaurs that didn't die out. Why? We don't know.
But you're right, Julie. So
you're
there you
right,
go.
Julie. You get the slab of beer.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks. Bye.
See you later. Melanie's calling in from Woodend this morning. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, how are you going?
Great. What's your question?
I was just calling to see what the really high temperatures in a microwave actually do to the nutrients in food.
Well, the temperatures are not very high. They can only get to 100 degrees centigrade, whereas in an oven, you can easily get to 200 or 300.
Oh, okay.
But because, and they're limited to 100 degrees because at that point the water starts to boil and you just keep on throwing in the temperature, and then when all the water's gone, then the food doesn't get any hotter because there's no water to transfer the heat.
Does it do any damage though?
No, it's based upon two reports. One is a report in The Lancet that shows, and this is back in 1989, that if you get milk and you boil the crap out of it for 20 minutes with a microwave, the milk proteins will change into something bad. Mate, you get some bread and you toast it for 20 minutes until it's raw charcoal, you've got all sorts of bad chemicals in there. So that was one bit of proof. And the other one is an article by Hans Hertel in the modestly named journal Franz Weber, where they got a bunch of vegetarians who are already anemic and then fed them microwaved and non-microwaved food, and then using a series of tests not known to Western society, proved that the food was somehow deficient. And the proof is just ridiculous because they use things like, well, by getting the magnet and waving it near you, the magnet changes the shape of the circle, thus proving that the food is bad. In fact, the opposite is true with regard to microwaved food. Microwaved food has more nutrients in it than any other form of cooking. Minerals such as sodium and potassium are mostly soluble in water, so they're better off being microwaved. Fats and carbohydrates are basically unaffected by both regular heating and microwaving, and proteins suffer less oxidation in a microwave oven than in conventional cooking because of lower temperatures and shorter time. And in fact, the lack of browning is proof that the heating is gentle. On the other hand, microwaving is more suitable for reheating than for delicious primary cooking, and it's not as delicious. So microwaving does less damage.
Okay.
And does regular cooking.
There you go, Melanie. Answered
Fantastic.
For you. Thanks for the call.
See you
later. Peter's calling in from Sydney this morning. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you going?
Very well. You're getting into beer garden territory as we head towards summer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What's your question?
So basically, yeah, I've noticed, and a few of my friends have noticed as well, so just to clarify, it's not me going crazy. When you step outside and you're drinking a beer, normally in a schooner, so it's really open on top, the beer suddenly tastes completely different. It gets a sort of a tang to it. And I'm wondering what caused it, essentially. And my theories are that it's something to do with either air temperature affecting the alcohol on the surface of the beer, or maybe it's the wind.
So how are the conditions different from inside the beer garden to outside with regard to wind and temperature and sunlight? What's the difference?
Well, it's happened. I mean, there's no real, I guess, consistency that I've noticed. I mean, it's happened at bowling clubs. It used to happen to me in Canberra when we go outside at night. But also, yeah, in the middle of the day up the coast when it's warm. So I guess air movement would be the main difference that's consistent. But, I guess all the time the temperature does change, but whether it goes up or down doesn't seem to have a pattern.
It's not a psychological thing of, hey, I'm breaking the licensing laws, I'm a wild, crazy, hoodlum character, here I am drinking beer 1 metre outside the boundary, whoa, and the beer tastes good with the extra bright.
It actually tastes worse.
It may have to do with the smell in the environment. When you're inside the beer garden, isn't there other food and other smells around? You step outside and suddenly you're smelling, pollution, plants, whatever it is.
Yep.
Well, smell is one factor because it's very strongly associated with food, and some people who go surfing get a blow on the head, and the cribriform, cribriform plate in their upper nose shifts a tiny bit. It's got a million holes through which a million nerves go, and at that moment they lose forever their sense of smell, and they'll say that the food forever after never tastes as good. So you're saying that when you go outside, the beer doesn't taste as good.
Yeah, it sort of just gets a little funny tang to it, and it's the moment you step out the door.
Mate, if you were to write this up in an experiment and then get a whole lot of people, and then you could get a Triple J fun pack next year. Do it over the Christmas period.
Yes, your work's cut out for you over summer, Peter. Let us know how you go.
I'll get on to it.
Thanks
to
for the call, mate.
Cheers, guys.
See you later.
Thanks,
we're talking science. We're halfway through this science hour. Give us a buzz, 1-300-055-36. Dr. Carl and Brian Dunning joining us to take five. I mean, to talk science. Oh, God. I think I need to go to a beer garden.
Your choice.
Can you tell it's getting towards the end of the year? Oh. Sandro sitting in with you for the second last science hour of 2010. Dr. Carl's with us, and we have a special guest, Brian Dunning, in studio, the guy behind the Skeptoid podcast, skeptoid.com, if you haven't caught up with it yet, and he is busting myths. We're trying to this morning with your questions. Give us a buzz, 1-300-055-36. We have Steve on the road in WA. Where are you at the moment, Steve?
Just outside of Bunno,
as in Bunbury, or is there actually a
place
called
Bunno?
What is your question, Steve?
My question for the Dr. Carl and Dr. Dunning, the succubus theory, the energy created from the Zeitgeist movement.
I know about the Zeitgeist movement, and I know about the succubus theory in terms of people who call themselves energy vampires, but I'm not aware of any connection between the two. What?
I'm just trying to figure out, is it possible that people can produce that kind of energy, negative and positive, that create an energy that goes onto other people?
Certainly anything is possible, but no such energy field has ever been detectable. It has no properties that can be described or measured. Any such energy fields as that are purely theoretical, and anyone who is talking about their ability to be drained or measured or taken from one person to another is trying to think of a word I can use on the radio.
Deluded?
No.
They're full of it.
Well,
it's strange because I think everybody knows somebody who's got that kind of energy about them.
What, they're a bit of a Debbie Downer?
Yeah, like if they're on a downer, that they make it a downer, and if they're on an upper, they're a real live wire.
I think that people can affect moods, but as far as taking your energy...
Yeah, you know, personality does not depend on the presence of some theoretical energy field. There's plenty going on in your brain to explain your mood and your personality.
Now, look, if you want to know more about this, Steve, Brian from Skeptoid.com has written and performed a wonderful podcast specifically about the Zeitgeist movie and the philosophy behind that. So that's worthwhile listening to. It runs for a nice little 10 minutes.
Yeah, you can go to Skeptoid.com and just search for Zeitgeist.
All right.
Secondly, this is where I awkwardly put in a plug for my TV show, Sleek Geeks, which is happening tonight on ABC TV at 8 o'clock at night. Thirdly, there is no such thing as an energy field. A field has a direction. You can have a magnetic field and you can have an electric field, but energy is not a vector. It does not have a direction. You cannot have an energy field. You can have an energy or you can have a field. You can have a magnetic field, you can have an electric field. It is impossible to have an energy field because of the definition of what a field is. And thirdly, when I was doing psychiatry, one of my bosses sent me in to take an interview of somebody, a bunch of people, and there were some people who were saying, I'm really depressed. And it turned out that they didn't really have depression. But there was one person who said, yeah, it's okay. And they just metaphorically, they suck the energy out of me. And he said that if you're with somebody and they say they're okay, but you feel really drained, that person could well be suffering from depression. And depression is not just, gee, I feel unhappy because the milk wasn't good in my tea today, but it can be a life-threatening, e.g. through suicide, condition. So that's just something to be aware of in the background.
Definitely.
Thanks for the call, Steve.
It was a theory. It was something that was just theoretical. So.
No, it's not never been proven. And I reckon if you want some more, then jump onto skeptoid.com and you can follow up with Brian's information about it online. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks very much for that, doctor.
See you later. Mate, Nathan's calling in from Mulgrave this morning. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, doctors.
What's your question?
I've been brought up under the impression, well, they teach you in school that smoke rises. Often we're sitting around the table with friends having a drink and a smoke and what have you. My dog hangs around the table as well. Now, sometimes you see sort of smoke kind of floating through the air and often it almost kind of drops down a bit. Is my dog taking any of this secondhand smoke, or does the smoke ever change from, you know, it going up to... you know, do the particles change to start to fall down, or...?
A combination of yes and no. If you're taking a dog for a walk, on a warm summer's day and your temperature at your face is 25, the microclimate from the ground for about 10, 20, 30 centimetres up can be up to 35, 40. And so your dog can be practically dying in the equivalent of a sauna while you're chatting to somebody else. So there's that factor. Secondly, the smoke can rise and then it can also fall, and it will diffuse out at a rate proportional to the square root of the time. So you can affect your dog.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, smoke is just basically very small particles of ash, and it's gonna float in the air currents wherever the air currents happen to go.
Yeah, because you see in people's houses that smoke, they get the yellow ceilings and that, but it's, you know, it's always the ceiling. It's not really often the walls or
that's
the
first
very
place.
Tops of the walls.
Yeah, it first but, rises, then it falls.
Yeah,
as it cools
so
down.
Does the source of the smoke, like what the smoke, you know, well, whatever's burning, creates the smoke? Does the different items burning create different types of smoke, or will it affect the amount that the smoke rises?
Oh, all of that, because you create bad chemicals when you burn anything. And so the old backyard bonfire would put out more dioxins, D-I-O-X-I-N-S, than a properly run incinerator. So it's a really complicated topic, combustion. But if you're burning anything, you get all sorts of chemicals coming out.
Hey, thanks for the call, Nathan.
Thank you, Dr. Nathan. Thanks.
Take care of your dog as well. Poor little dog.
Smoking.
Secondhand smoking. Daniel's calling in from Rosanna this morning. Hi, Daniel.
G'day, doctors. How are you?
Very well. What have you been doing at home?
Well, it was a while ago. I still don't do this, but every light bulb that used to break, die at home, I'd take out the back, bury, and then just practice throwing a hockey ball at it until they broke, and then bury the glass into the ground.
Bury the glass into the ground?
Quite deeply, not into the surface.
So this means in 15 years' time, when somebody else moves into the house, they're going to cut their hands on this glass?
Hopefully not. It's actually quite deep. I was thoughtful, sort of. But one light bulb in particular, it was just the same as every other one. I threw the hockey ball at it, and it hit the light bulb, but it didn't smash. It just bent the filaments over almost to a 90-degree angle.
So a shockwave went in, and the filaments bent, but the glass envelope did not shatter.
That's completely intact.
Well, the filaments inside the glass bulb bent as if they had been hit.
Yeah.
Like the glass.
Yep.
Mm.
And it's completely fine, and
you have magic glass.
Brian's giving us a look as though he's about to bust a myth. He's got his super myth-busting gaze on. Do you think it's possible, Brian?
Well, certainly those filaments are quite fragile and they can easily break and bend.
Yeah.
And especially when a light bulb is turned on, they're especially flexible. And you know, that's one of the ways that they determine what happened in an air crash is they look at the filaments inside the light bulbs on the on the instrument display to see which way they were bent. They can tell which way the plane struck.
Oh, wow.
How that would happen, I think your filaments are probably just broken or bent, and it probably had very little to do with getting hit by the hockey puck.
Okay, because it was because the actual wire in between the filaments broke like it does when a normal light bulb dies, but then after the hockey ball hit it, there's a tiny little mark on the glass, and yeah, from that direction, they're bent down towards the bottom of the bulb.
Okay, glass is theoretically weight for weight stronger than steel.
Yeah.
And what weakens it is the series of impacts from air molecules moving at hundreds, if not nearly 1,000 kilometres per hour, causing minor fractures. Glass is incredibly strong, but also incredibly brittle. And if you do some tricks to the glass, like coat it with plastic and then have laminated layers, or you do special heating and cooling, you can make the outside less brittle, and so that is not brittle, and then the inside strength of the glass comes through.
Okay.
It is virtually impossible for the average human to break an egg by clutching it with their fist and then just squeezing. And the way you do this to trick the kids at the Christmas party is you have a ring on one finger and you swivel it around so that the ring creates a tiny nick in the glass. In the same way, the glass creates a nick in the egg and then you can break it after the kids have tried like crazy. In the same way, glass is potentially very strong because you've got that lovely spherical shape.
Mm.
So all I'm thinking is that one of your light bulbs, when it came through the factory years and years and years ago, might have been hit with a slightly different heat treatment process. And so it's less brittle, and so its true strength can come through.
I'm glad that you're not burying broken glass in the backyard, though, anymore, Dan.
No, that's it wasn't quite a while ago.
You're a good boy,
not
Dr.
a good thing
Daniel.
To ever do ever again.
Yep, definitely not.
Okay.
Doesn't biodegrade.
Throw it into the street instead.
Yeah. Oh, no.
No, Brian.
No.
Hey, thanks for the call, Daniel.
Thank you very much for the answer.
We're talking science for the next 15 minutes or so. 1-300-055-536. Right now we're talking science for just a little while longer. Dr. Carl is with us. Brian Dunning, a professional skeptic. Yeah, that is joining us. Skeptoid.com is his podcast if you want to catch up with what he does for fun, and I think it's a lot of fun. And Justin from Tamworth is on the line with possibly a skeptical question. Good morning, Justin.
Mm-hmm. Good day, doctors. How are you?
What's your question?
My friend came down from Sydney last week, and he told me a lot about the Illuminati. He told me things like that there was a driver that killed John F. Kennedy. He had a Luger. They were responsible for the World Trade Center going down. Princess Di, Tupac. Is there any truth to any of this stuff?
The Illuminati sound like they've been busy. Who are the Illuminati?
That's the big question, is who are the Illuminati? There are so many conspiracy theories. There are more than you can shake a stick at. And often they're just described by this nebulous term, the Illuminati. So really, that question is much too vague to be able to address at all. You know, you've got all sorts of powerful influences the world. You know, money, economies, things like this. Who really controls them? Wars, and obviously there are powerful institutions that were set up to control these things: banks, governments, etc. Conspiracy theories claim to. See, obviously, there's been real conspiracies in the world. We've uncovered real conspiracies. That doesn't necessarily mean that conspiracy theories about trying to predict future events or saying that some secret entity is controlling everything, that doesn't mean that those are true. So far, nobody has ever come up with a conspiracy theory that claims to predict future events that has turned out to be true. So if your friend is saying that X is controlled by Y, this entity is planning to take over the world via mechanism Q. So far, none of those theories has ever panned out to be true. Really, it's just a bunch of kind of internet conspiracy mongering that there's no evidence for. It's one thing to look and say, hey, this is consistent with this hidden entity controlling this, or, you know, Dick Cheney knew this person, or whatever. That's not evidence that the conspiracy theory is true. There's all sorts of things that you can theorize that this is consistent with that. But so far, none of them have never panned out.
And the bottom line seems to be that they, whoever they are, secretly run the world from behind the scenes, have done so for hundreds of years, and are doing it right now. And anything that pops up is their doing.
Yeah, that's what he's pretty much trying to tell me. He talks about the all-seeing eye and the $1 bill and...
He's coming in a few centuries late on his conspiracy theory.
What's the $1 bill theory?
Well, there's a triangle with like an eye in it.
Yes.
It's a Masonic symbol, and many of the founding fathers of the United States were Freemasons. There's no mystery about that. There's nothing hidden about that at all.
Yeah, right, so the stonemasons, that's where it comes into it.
Mm.
Yeah, right.
You know what, it's weird. In mentioning the stonemasons, I think that I heard somewhere recently that they've always been, and the Freemasons have always been a relatively secret society, but now they're losing members. They've become really public, and they're trying to have, like, getting to know you. Come along and meet your local stonemason or Freemason. So it's totally flipped it around in 2010 because no one wants to join the Freemasons anymore. Thanks for the call, Justin.
Thank you, Justin.
See you later. Andrew's calling in from Penrith. Hi, Andrew.
There you go.
Great. What's your question?
I've heard that boiling water freezes faster than cold water.
This goes back to a Nigerian student in the 1980s, and they didn't have a lot of science facilities in that country in his school or any school, but they did have a fridge, and they did have a way of cooking water, and as a part of something else, he put both hot water and cold water in the freezer at the same time, and to his surprise, repeatedly the hot water would freeze sooner than the cold water. And because it had more heat to get rid of, it seems kind of wrong. It's been followed up in the pages of The New Scientist and various physics magazines. There's a whole bunch of proper of analysis of it. Number one, it does seem to be weakly real. It will tend to happen more often than not. Secondly, we don't know why. There's a whole bunch of reasons, like if you boil the water, maybe the calcium and other things come out of solution, or maybe you're setting up more circulation currents. We don't know why it happens. It seems to be weakly true. M-P-E-M-B-A, I think is how it's spelled. Look it up on Wikipedia.
Thanks for the call.
To the science.
Thanks for the call, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew.
Also, we had Stuart from Grafton, who's a beer brewer, calling us up regarding what we were talking about with a caller about 15 minutes ago, that you had the theory that
differently when you go
as soon
out
as you sat
garden.
Outside a beer or stepped outside a beer garden, even if you're already outdoors, the beer tasted differently. He says that UV light reacts with beer releasing sulfur compounds. It happens when beers with beers that use a certain type of hop oil. That's why beer bottles are brown to keep the light out. But if you're already in the beer garden, and unless you're sort of completely in shade and then completely in sun,
you're still
outdoors. You could still be in the sun. So,
that'd be an interesting experiment for those who want to get a Triple J fun pack early next year, to be in the shade themselves, but to put the beer in the sunlight and then compare the beer in the sunlight with some beer in the shade.
I have a feeling that won't be a hard experiment over summer. Okay. Let us know how you go, Nation. We have Giddy on the line from Bayswater. Hi, Giddy.
Hi.
What's your question?
I was just wondering how the body knows that bone density... how the body increases bone density when you do weight-bearing exercise. Because I know if you do want to build your muscles, like you do weights and you tear a few muscles and they build up stronger, but do you, like... break your bones a little bit to build weight to build bone density? How does that happen? How does your body know?
In your bones are two types of cells, the osteoblasts, B for blast, B for build, and they constantly rebuild your bones from incoming calcium. Then, of course, the opposite are the osteoclasts, which destroy your bones, get the calcium, throw it into your bloodstream, then into your gut, then into your toilet bowl, then to a beach near you, which is how we do sewerage in Australia. And so over a 7 to 10 year period, all the calcium atoms in your bone have gone. They've been replaced by other calcium atoms. And in the same way, if you do exercise, your bones will remodel themselves. They will reshape themselves. They will rebuild themselves like the guy in the best movie ever made, Terminator 2, starring the silver guy and the current governor of California. So the point is that your bones rebuild themselves on the run in response to stresses. And so if you are to start pumping iron, then you will build up your muscle bigger. The muscle will be joined to a tendon. The tendon will be joined to a bone. And the bone will grow a little bony outcrop.
Oh, so it does.
It does it on the run.
It does feel it.
It feels it. And then if you do the experiment of getting some astronauts and putting them in orbit, the poor buggers, via analysing their bones when they come back with double photon something analysis, and by analysing what they put out in the toilet bowl, they lose calcium like crazy. And if you give them a little hammer built into their shoe on the heel, and in one shoe there is no hammer. On the other shoe, there's a little hammer that goes bang, 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 bang all the time at a low rate on their heel, blow me down, that the bones in that leg have less osteoporosis. So your bones, and we don't know exactly the mechanism why, will remodel themselves and give themselves more calcium in response to external stresses, such as walking, jumping, or hitting yourself with a bone.
In fact, when we look at skeletons from archaeological sites, this is one way we can tell who was a laborer, what kind of work they were doing. It's by looking at which of their bones are robust, and you can see where the muscle attachments were, where they were particularly highly muscled. I was reading recently about one skeleton. He was very robust on one side, and the bones on his other side were very gracile. And
or
it was determined that this guy had been paralyzed on one side of his body. And we can actually tell that just by looking at his bones.
There you go.
Okay. So why doesn't your bone density increase when you do swimming? Because that's using your muscles.
Not enough of an impact sport, because you're using the muscles, but not in sudden jolts. It helps if there's a sudden bump. But if you just do a slow, gradual push, it doesn't build up. It will improve the relentless osteoporosis that's coming upon all of us, but not enough. Swimming is good for some things in general. It's a low-impact sport that doesn't damage your bones or your joints, but it is not good for fighting osteoporosis. But it's good for other things.
Thanks for the call, Giddy.
Thank you.
And can I say that Little Bony Outcrop is going to be added to my list of good band names. Thank you, Dr. Carl. Skeptoid.com is the place that you can find Brian Dunning's podcast, which he updates all the time with his myth-busting adventures. And Brian, it's been great to have you in this morning. Thanks so much for joining us to talk science. Next week, one last science hour with Dr. Carl for 2010. We will see you there. It's going to be a big one. See you next week.
Bye.